Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapanchik. On today's show, we'll hear an interview with Chris Mooney, co-author of the book Unscientific America: How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Internet Freedom Preservation Act, a bill that would protect so-called network neutrality and establish rules of the road for an open Internet, was introduced in Congress last week by Democratic Representatives Edward Markey of Massachusetts and Anna Eshoo of California. Calling the Internet an essential infrastructure, Markey said that the national economy would be severely harmed if content, service, and application providers were slowed down or blocked by broadband network operators. Free Press campaign coordinator Misty Perez-Trudson says the bill would put net neutrality protections into the law once and for all.
The law would prevent Internet service providers from controlling our access to content, services, and applications on the Internet. This means that we will continue to be able to enjoy the open Internet as it is today, without corporate gatekeepers controlling what we can access on the Internet.
As more information, entertainment, and communications move online, phone and cable companies are viewing the Internet as a direct threat to their bottom line and traditional business models.
Rather than adapt and welcome new innovative models, phone and cable companies are scrambling for control of the Internet in order to drive traffic towards their sites and to turn up their profits while shutting out competition.
Without a law that keeps the Internet open to all competitors, she says, we could lose our freedom to pick and choose where we want to go online.
Whether it's access news and information, or communicate with our family members across the nation or around the world, or whether it's look up our favorite movie and watch it online. Without that access, the Internet will change. It won't be the open Internet that we've all become accustomed to. It will be an Internet controlled by Internet service providers.
This is the third time that a net neutrality bill has been introduced in Congress. Perez-Trudson says that a different climate in Washington and the growing importance of the Internet for economic development and democratic participation increase the chance of the bill getting passed.
I think the bill's going to pass this time because we have a pro-network neutrality president. The chair of the FCC is very supportive of network neutrality, and the public support is continuing to grow and only getting stronger.
For more information about the Internet Freedom Preservation Act and net neutrality, go to savetheinternet.com.
The Transmission Project is on a mission of its own, to amplify the power of public media and community technology. They place AmeriCorps Vista volunteers in nonprofit organizations across the country. Belinda Rollins is the executive director of the Transmission Project, formerly known as CTC Vista. She says that as the nearly 10-year-old program grew, the organization eagerly took on opportunities to expand the scope of their work beyond their original efforts to place volunteers at community technology centers.
As the CTCNet membership started to expand beyond the very traditional one-room computer centers and housing developments, church basements, community centers, and started to incorporate more organizations that were involved in media arts, public access television, all sorts of different technology centers, the mission of CTC Vista started to broaden out to incorporate a wider variety of organizations.
The name Transmission Project reflects the evolution of the effort. Rollins explains.
We needed to come up with a word that would actually cross different technologies, cross disciplines. So we're actually going across missions, transmission, around public media and public technology in the country.
Public media is central to the work of the Transmission Project, but their definition of the term expands beyond the familiar outlets of PBS and NPR. Instead, Rollins explains that a range of media, from public access television to wireless mesh networks, can be public media if they are accessible by the public and utilized for the public good. Volunteers are working with a wide range of organizations this year, such as the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project in Lowell, Massachusetts.
They are working to develop distance learning opportunities for rural, independent, and organic farmers nationwide. So we've placed someone with their organization to help them to develop the strategy to not only create that delivery system for the learning opportunities, but also to then do the outreach campaign and fundraising campaign to make sure that it continues on at the end of the year.
Transmission Project also placed a volunteer with Reclaim the Media, a Seattle-based media reform group.
Reclaim the Media in Seattle is working on a digital media literacy curriculum that will be used both with organizations nationwide and also individuals in their communities.
To learn more about the work of the Transmission Project, visit transmissionproject.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with Chris Mooney, co-author of the book Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, August 2nd, 2009.
We are joined on the phone by Chris Mooney. Chris Mooney is a contributing editor to Science Progress and the author of the best-selling book, The Republican War on Science. He contributes to a number of publications, including Wired, Slate, and The American Prospect. He lives in Princeton, New Jersey, but right now he is in California on a book tour for his new book, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, which he co-wrote with the scientist Cheryl Kirschenbaum. The book is published by Basic Books. And Chris is joining us on the phone from California. Chris, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let's begin by talking about some of the basics about writing the book. I imagine that this call regarding scientific literacy and its threat to our future is not a new one. But why, if that's the case, why write the book?
Well, two things. First, it is not an entirely new one. People have been concerned with scientific literacy in various ways for many decades. The matter is pressing now because, for one of two reasons, at least scientists now are very dismayed that having made all these great advances, they clearly feel like the American public doesn't follow along, that other citizens that aren't scientists just miss out on all of the great knowledge and also miss out on its relevance to them, why it can change their lives and why it can affect the country's future. And that's the second reason that it's so important now, right? It's that, a large array of policy issues have a scientific component to them, and legislators, average citizens, don't see those components, aren't aware of the relevance of science to major decisions.
You, early on in the book, you talk about some of the scale or scope regarding matters regarding how ignorant Americans tend to be with regards to science. There are some factoids here that just read from the inside cover of the book. For every 5 hours of cable television news, 1 minute is devoted to science. 46% of Americans believe the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. The number of newspapers with science sections has shrunken by two-thirds in the last 20 years. I guess the question I would ask is, this really isn't new either, or maybe it's gotten worse. What's the scale or scope regarding ignorance of science among the American public?
It's pretty bad. If you just ask, factual questions about things that one would expect everybody learned in high school, then you often only get half the public in a survey answering correctly. So you ask something about, like, how long does it take the Earth to rotate around the sun? Only half of Americans, know that it takes the Earth a year to rotate around the sun, or that the Earth rotates around the sun. You ask them something like, what's smaller, an atom or an electron, or what's larger, an atom or an electron? They bomb on that. At least half of people do. More than half of people bomb on a factual question about the Big Bang. So, evolution, the anti-evolution numbers are astounding, and you cited those. So there's a lot of lack of knowledge out there. I think that that's lamentable. It's regrettable. It is not the only issue, and we shouldn't necessarily treat it as the most important issue, because separate from what people factually know is, you know, what they pay attention to, how they feel, what they regard as important. And science isn't doing well in those other, you know, more fluffy categories either.
Has this always been the case that Americans have tended to be rather ignorant of science? I mean, I imagine you certainly, like, say, during the space race in the 1960s, that science was certainly not only held in esteem, but also that I imagine that there was probably a greater awareness of science. Do we have any historical data about whether or not it's actually been worse or better?
Well, we would argue that, yeah, what you said is actually the case. We know... It depends on what kind of data you want. I don't have comparative data available. I'm not sure these questions were asked then. But I can tell you, you know, if you just go back over the history, you find a moment in America when science was at the center of what everybody was talking about, what politicians were talking about, what the society was talking about, and that was the time of the space race. Now, I'm sure there were some people that tuned out even then, but when you look at the policies that were unleashed and you look at, you know, what journalists were covering and all of that, it's a very different time.
The book tends to focus on, well, a number of things, but I think two pressing questions that it tries to tackle are, one, how did this happen, this astounding ignorance or maybe indifference to science among Americans generally, and question two is, what can we do about it? To tackle the first question, there are a number of chapters that are actually devoted to separate components about this. There are two that I kind of see as related, both having to do with the media, one having to do with the state of journalism and science journalism in the United States, of how it's been kind of dismal, and also the role that Hollywood has played. Let's talk about journalism first. This is kind of connected as well with the state of media concentration, that as companies have grown bigger, media companies have grown bigger, devotion to the bottom line has grown ever-pressing, and science journalism and science coverage has gotten the axe. Is this a correct assessment?
Yeah, that's one of the central factors contributing to the decline of science journalism, which is well-documented, and everybody in science writing or science media knows that occurring right now. The people who used to be the go-betweens to explain science to the public, now they might not have always done as great a job of it as you or I might have hoped, but at least they were doing a job of it. Now they don't have jobs. But the other factor there, I mean, not to be neglected, and actually I think probably more powerful, is not media concentration, but rather just technological change. So basically cable and the internet changed the media dramatically, and the internet in particular is leading pretty directly to the decline of newspapers and the loss of jobs of science journalists. Cable did something else, and that also, I think, has been very detrimental to the sense that there is, you know, one body of information that everyone in America should know about science, which, you know, that's just, you know, impossible to hope for anymore.
There's also the role that another chapter actually devotes to another component with regards to media, Hollywood, or maybe writ large, the entertainment industry. Now, I could see actually someone, maybe a devil's advocate, who might say, hey, there's coverage about science, even if indirectly, in Hollywood or in coverage. You've got, say, medical or forensic TV shows like CSI or House or movies like Twister or movies like The Day After Tomorrow. So, hey, there's some science out there. How would you respond whenever someone responds like this?
Well, no, it's a very good point. And we even say in the chapter that while Hollywood stereotypes of scientists might have been negative for some time, that might actually be changing today. And you do see a lot of science-centered entertainment. It's too soon to tell, I think, whether it's a real big cultural change. But we argue, yeah, there's certainly, you know, there's the science fiction genre, which is one that, you know, contains a vast number of major blockbusters in it, like Jurassic Park or Armageddon or something like that. So clearly Hollywood has found that science content, you know, sells. But what we go on to say is that when you look historically at how scientists have been depicted in entertainment, you generally generally find a variety of stereotypes that that have left people with a slightly negative view of the scientist. And stereotypes, I think they're the nerd, the oddball, socially dysfunctional, etc., or they're the bad guy, the villain, sort of the evil genius. And those stereotypes have been shown to actually make their way, not that this would surprise anybody, but to make their way right into the minds of young children who, when they think of scientists, expect them to be like that. So if that's changing all to the good, I'd like to see some data on it. The bad scientist tradition goes way, 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 way back. And I certainly see the geeks everywhere in Hollywood even today. So it may be changing, but it certainly had a big effect.
What kind of data would you hope to see?
Someone just going through, you'd have to crunch it, as has been done for the tradition that I talked about, the mad scientist, the negative scientist. You have to actually crunch, you have to analyze content and sort of see how scientists are depicted consistently. I'm not going to hazard a guess. I think it probably has become more positive for reasons that I'm not entirely sure I can put a finger on, but I haven't seen that data.
Well, that sounds like a homework assignment for someone. If these trends continue, here's where I'm going to ask you to try to look into your crystal ball for a second. Let's say that the trends that you've been documenting in this book and that you've been talking about continue unchecked. What do you foresee as some of the consequences that might result not only to America, but maybe the world, science ignorance and science apathy remain unchecked?
Well, first let's start with America. What we fear, my co-author and I, is a situation in which essentially you got the scientists, this is kind of what we already have, but it's just, perpetuating it. The scientists know what's up. They know what's going on in science and they know why it matters. But they are an incredibly small slice of the public, and everybody else is just totally, totally missing it. Totally not tuned in, doesn't know why they ought to be tuned in. Science is seen as a specialty or a special interest group in politics or something esoteric. And that will lead to a situation for the U.S. and globally, although, it's a different situation for the relationship between science and the public in different countries. So that's a huge can of worms. But it will affect us all in the sense that there are some big issues coming. Global warming's one. It's already come, and we've already mishandled it. But it is a great example of this kind of issue. There are big issues out there that are going to keep on coming where we need scientists and the public to be more in tune with one another, because otherwise either the public is going to be very upset about something that scientists do or create in all the sort of various bioethical arenas, or the public is just not going to know about the importance of an issue the way scientists do, which is more like what happened with global warming, where scientists were worried for a long time, and we still can't get it on the radar.
Here's a quick, maybe factual question, maybe you know this. When you're talking about a small percentage of the slice of Americans who are either science or science fans writ large, what's the percentage there? Any idea of what the number is of the percentage of the population of Americans that we're talking about?
I can't give you, off the top of my head, I'm sure that it exists, how many people are scientists in the United States. I can give you some numbers that help. Only 18% of Americans personally know a scientist. So roughly a fifth, less than a fifth, really actually knows a person who is a scientist. And that's pretty important.
Here's this discrepancy that I've noticed, especially that was raised early on in the book. At the same time that there's this big disconnect, nonetheless, the United States globally is seen as something of a leader. You've got major research institutions like laboratories, usually connected with either corporations or with major universities. You've got people from all over the world who are vying to try to come to the United States for research. And you've got a tremendous body of scientific breakthroughs that have not only here in Chicago, that have taken place, but have also across the United States. We've got a great tradition here of science, I might argue. And yet you've got this disconnect, and I guess once upon a time, We held that kind of place in not just worldwide as a kind of scientific pantheon, but also among the public. I guess my question is, can this state of affairs be restored where scientists were held more in higher esteem among the public?
Yeah, I think it definitely can. And so we have, the reason we lead the world in science is, among other things, we really invested in it, 50 some odd years ago. And we kept the investments mostly going, throughout the whole Cold War. To some extent, they've continued up to the present. We spend more money on science than any other nation in the world. But that doesn't mean that we have a public that really knows what's going on or that really follows it all. That's a very, very different matter. So the U.S. is invested in science. And if we're ceding our lead now, as we may be, it's partly because other countries are finally, catching up. But to get the public back, in touch with the scientists more is a very different issue that goes far beyond research dollars to scientists. It definitely has to do with, how much the media puts science on the agenda and how much average people are made to think that science is something that they really need to pay attention to. I think that we can improve. I think that, honestly, we might actually be improving. Certainly, the president is a very science-centered guy, and that's different from the last administration. So it's hard to untangle everything. But we know there are periods in history when this has been much more focused, and there's no reason to think we can't have another one.
One of the things that's called for, I guess we can turn now to that second question of, and maybe we already have, turn to that second question of how do we try to correct this state of affairs that would not only affect all Americans, but you might argue globally, because, global warming is going to affect every country in the world. Some disease that breaks out into a plague is not going to just stay confined if it spreads out. It'll affect everyone. And so I guess the question is, what do we do about it? And one call is to try to, and that's been mentioned in the book, is to try to foster some kind of interconnectivity, increasingly so, between scientists and the public in various ways. Two questions here. One is, is this something you would call for? And two, what would this look like?
Fixing the problem has multiple components. And the most obvious one is just improving U.S. science education. It's in a dismal state, and multiple studies have documented just how poorly we're serving our kids in terms of teaching them about science. So I think that's obvious. The problem is it's really hard. It's been talked about for a long time. It's a massive problem. Fixing journalism is also a massive problem, and it's hard to see where the answer is. Everything is going in the direction away from having everybody receive a lot of information about science through the media. Everything's splitting up and becoming atomized. So there has to be some way for science to reach out through a very different media than it had 50 years ago. And then the part that we talk about that you've highlighted is making scientists more engaged with the public. Because the public is, if it's not coming to them, can the scientists come to the public? And that's something we focus a lot of time on, because there's a real hunger for that, actually, in the scientific world right now. There's a lot of young people in science who are looking for ways in which they can do precisely this thing. They don't want to just be researchers, bench researchers. They really want to be involved with the rest of America. And they're trying to find ways to do that. And that's the thing, is that there aren't many opportunities or jobs for them to do that. It's not clear exactly what that looks like, because there aren't careers in it. Our argument is, we certainly can make some suggestions, but our argument is, give them opportunities, create, institutions and nonprofit jobs and fellowships and so forth, and let them innovate, let them find ways of doing it, and you will see amazing results, because these are very creative people who really are full of energy and want to affect change, and it's just a question of giving them the opportunity to do that.
Let me go talk more about the book itself and response to it. The book has been released, as we're doing this recording, it's only been probably about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks since the book's release. Is this correct?
Yeah, although you can't really talk about release on a particular day anymore. You got Kindle out,
Ah, that's right.
2 weeks before print's out, basically. Yeah.
Okay, well, here's what I'm getting at. What's been the response of the book since its release or releases, as the case may be?
well, the response to the book is an amazing thing to see. It is it's quite polarized, actually. You know, a lot of people, especially in science, love this book. They're treating it as kind of like, you know, sort of a paradigm shifting book where it finally says to the people in science, all right, wake up, you know, we've lost the public, we've won the research, we've lost the public, now's the time to finally change and to finally do something that we didn't do all those years, which is try to understand America. That's one response out there. Then there's other responses that this is a, you know, horrible, simplistic misrepresentation of science and scientists. And that's coming from people who are mainly angry about one chapter that we didn't discuss, which is where we talk about science and religion.
Mm.
And we're very hard on the scientists who attack religion, although we're certainly also very hard on the religious people who attack science. But we're quite balanced about that, and the people that we criticize there are very upset.
Well, this actually might be a moment to talk about that. So I can understand why some religious folks might attack science. You could see examples. The most notable is that of the debates over evolution. You also talk about who we refer to as the new atheists, people, some of whom are part of the scientific community, who basically regard all of religion as just basically worthless garbage. Am I pushing the right button in talking about these things?
Yeah. So our book has made the new atheists very angry. And so that's why the response is polarized, is that for them, there's just one chapter about them, and they read the whole book through that lens. And, you know, a lot of people aren't really, they take our approach more like, you know, the new atheists are obviously going too far. It's obvious to many people, and so then they're more inclined to like the book. So first of all, we have a huge problem with science and religion in America. And it's an incredibly polarizing and emotional issue for people, and it's clearly one of the main factors that keeps Americans away from accepting science. So we had to treat it, right? Because if Americans view science as an attack on their religion, then Americans are not going to accept science insofar as they view it as an attack on faith, and a lot of Americans do. The evidence of that is very clear. It's coming from churches across the country. People are being told this. And that's really bad, and that's really damaging, and that's why we have, you know, we fight for decades and decades over evolution. And we have, and we probably will continue to. In that context, what we say in the book is that, look, you know, it's really lamentable that religion is one of the stumbling blocks here, but it's also quite clear that if you want to do something about that stumbling block, you can't think that crusading at people's faith and from a scientific position and actually advocating atheism is going to change that. Now, you know, there's freedom of speech. There should be arguments made for atheism. I actually am an atheist. But when you look at why people aren't accepting science, it has to do with faith. And so if science becomes an enemy of faith, then it's clearly not going to help the cause of science. And it's just a very... very simple argument, backed up by considerable polling data, as well as experience from people in the field who've worked on things like the evolution issue. It's sort of common sense, but for making it in that way, we certainly have made some folks pretty upset.
I guess this might be the last question, and more of a personal one. You clearly have made a career regarding not only science, but also helping to raise awareness of matters pertaining to science and other spheres. How did you get interested in this stuff?
Personally, I'm a college English major who found a love of science that he sort of had always grown up with due to his grandfather's influence. He was an evolutionary biologist, and I got into this originally through the evolution route. So I know that area really pretty well. And so, you know, 2 years into college, reading novels, it was great, you know, but I really started getting into science. I was reading people like Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins and realizing that there was just an incredible power here to the arguments that I didn't necessarily have, and they were so directly relevant, reading old novels, so I sort of switched, and I've been doing it ever since.
We've been speaking with Chris Mooney. He and Cheryl Kirschenbaum are the authors of the new book, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris Mooney is also the author of the previous best-selling book, The Republican War on Science, contributes to other magazines, including Wired, Slate, and the American Prospect, lives in Princeton, New Jersey, but has been joining us over the phone from California. Chris Mooney, thank you very much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks.
That was an interview with Chris Mooney, recorded on August 2nd, 2009. Chris Mooney also contributes to the online blog The Intersection at blogs.discovermagazine.com/intersection. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.